broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. And now, for an hour of food and drink, in and around Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. In today's programme, we take a long overdue trip to the much-loved Orchard Tea Garden in Grantchester, where Matt discovers some quite surprising recent history. Not to be outdone, I discover some quite surprising things about coffee from barista Jack Kiff of Hot Numbers Coffee House in Gwydir Street.
Now, last weekend was the first Thirsty Festival. It featured wine, beer, gin and food, and I couldn't resist. So we have a feature from there. We've also got our regular contributors, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments, who will be talking about avoiding potato and tomato blight, and also about watering your crops. And our newest contributor, Dr. Sue Bailey, who's here to talk about salted and unsalted butter.
Dan Young from Noel Young Wines will be tipping us off about some new wines they have in stock. And at the end of the programme, we'll have the food and drink news for Cambridge. We'll also be keeping an eye out throughout the next hour for interesting food-related tweets. And you can contact us, studio@cambridge105.fm, or text us 07919 070 490.
Now, Alan, do you remember, I think it was about 5 years ago, we played the entirety of Pink Floyd's Grantchester Meadows on Flavour. That song must have been about 7 minutes 43, I think. It was a real luxury.
Yep.
Well, here's 10 minutes 31 of my recent visit to the Orchard Tea Rooms, also in Grantchester, but no Pink Floyd.
Oh, the factories may be roaring with the boom-a-lacka, zoom-a-lacka-wee. But there isn't any roar when the clock strikes four. Everything stops for tea.
So what we're trying to do here is maintain in the orchard a corner of England where time stands still as the outside world rushes by.
Gorgeous sunny day. Everybody is out.
We want people to relax and enjoy the gentle setting where more famous people have taken tea than probably anywhere else in the world.
I only know that you may lie day long and watch the Cambridge sky, and flower lulled in sleepy grass, hear the cool lapse of hours pass, until the centuries blend and blur in Grantchester, in Grantchester.
So I live just up the road in Trumpington. Just been out on a 40k bike ride, taking in the summer sunshine. Just stopped in at the Orchard Tea Rooms for a nice cup of tea and a scone with jam and lots of clotted cream.
Well, we have 300-something deck chairs out.
Okay.
And everyone is taken.
Bring tea for the gentleman, steak for the sun.
I'm Charles Bunker. I'm the director of the Orchard Tea Garden. The orchard was first planted in 1868. A group of Cambridge students asked Mrs. Stevenson of Orchard House if she would serve tea beneath the blossomed fruit trees rather than was as usual on the front lawn of her garden. They were unaware that on that spring morning, they'd started a great Cambridge tradition.
It's very relaxing. You know, you can understand why people have been spending their time up here for the last 200 years or so.
Very little has changed in the orchard since then. In order to supplement their income, the Stevensons took in lodgers at Orchard House. And in 1909, a young graduate of King's College, Cambridge, took up residence. His name was Rupert Brooke. Brooke had fallen in love with the idyllic life in Grantchester. On a trip to Berlin, he wrote one of his best-known poems, The Old Vicarage at Grantchester.
And little kindly winds that creep round twilight corners, half asleep.
Well, I first started coming to the orchard 15 or 16 years ago when I was down here as a postgrad. I now live on the north coast of Scotland, and I've come down to visit friends. But we always come down here. I love coming down here so much. It's so nice to be able to sit underneath the apple blossoms and have a nice cup of tea and homemade cakes. And it's just the atmosphere of the orchard. It's not one of these generic places where everything's standardised. It's homemade, it's a lovely atmosphere, you have children running around. It's just such a relaxing place to come to.
So we walked into the Orchard Tea Rooms from Cambridge City Centre and I couldn't believe the number of people there were punting up the river. It was brilliant.
Oh, is the water sweet and cool? Gentle and brown above the pool.
So you said that you've come back here after being away for 10 years.
That's right. We now live in Arizona. We lived here in Cambridgeshire for a little while, but this was one of our favorite places to come. But it was such a quintessential English place with so much history. We absolutely love it.
When we lived here, we didn't have children yet, and now we've got two little boys, and we wanted to bring them back to some of our favorite places, and top on the list was the Orchard.
And what have you been having here today?
Well, of course, we have to have the clotted cream and a fruit scone with some jam. And some Earl Grey.
The typical.
Yeah. We're in fact very proud. Our scones are made here every day. The chefs actually arrive here very early in the morning. They make the scones. They also make the bread. The bread that goes with the soup is all homemade here. And it's one of the reasons that we stop serving our light lunches at 3 o'clock, because we need our chefs to start building the next batch of scones for the afternoon teas. So it is the one thing, you know, the scones are made freshly every day. The cream specially comes from Cornwall. They're large cartons. We could certainly make money by scooping out industrial cream, but we choose the cream because it's the largest carton that we can get our cream from. The jam is Triptree dram from the Triptree farm in Essex. So, yeah, we take quite a lot of pride in the ingredients. And we have a fantastic group of chefs. Honestly, today, beating out under this wonderful May sun, we have to remember that while we're sitting under these beautiful trees, there is a team in there working damn hard to making sure that everybody else has a nice Sunday afternoon. So to my team in the kitchen, I praise them very highly and I say thank you very much.
And Arizona compared to this, my only frame of reference is the Nicolas Cage film.
Oh, Raging Arizona, right, yeah. But it's 100 degrees now there. So this is just a really nice, it's like for of spring, yeah, in Arizona. Have a cup of tea.
In 1987, the Orchard closed so that the land could be developed for residential housing. In 1992, however, it was acquired by a guy called Robin Callan. Robin Callan lived in Orchard House and he could not bear the thought of the Orchard being lost. But thanks to a loan from Midland Bank, he was able to come to a deal with his tax man, because that's really where he'd taken the money from in order to buy here, pay his tax bills, and really save this place for England. So he really was a buccaneering guy. He died about 2 years ago and was so passionate about here remaining forever England that under his will, he's given the Orchard Tea Gardens, so the land that's here and the land that comprises Orchard House, into a charitable trust. So, as he says, it can never be redeveloped. Robin loved the rustic wild growth of the orchard. To quote from his maintenance policy, "The Orchard Tea Garden is neither an orchard nor a tea garden. It's a nature reserve where people can take tea. Only the absolute minimum of pruning is permitted." This was not my chosen occupation. Robin Callan was my uncle. And so when he became poorly with Parkinson, and in the latter years, it became my responsibility. And so it remains today. So, as I say, the land's owned by charitable trustees, but the day-to-day operation remains in my hands, along with a wonderful general manager and a team to look after everybody.
Hi, my name's Liz, and I'm having a lovely cup of tea with my friend Teresa. Recently, I lost my father. She asked if I might like to come out and just take stock after making the funeral arrangements. So I said, oh, where shall we go? Because we like our tea rooms. It's by the river, birdsong, the trees are in blossom. So that's what we did. think we've now been here 3 hours. We've had lunch, tea, we've polished off a bottle of something non-alcoholic, and we've been serenaded by a robin sitting in the tree, and just telling Teresa how much my dad used to like taming the birds in his garden. Oh, can you hear the birthday celebrations? Oh, that's nice. So, yeah, it's a lovely place, the Orchard Tea Rooms. We're very lucky as locals to be able to come and visit it when we fancy.
He can take him to you.
Oscar, hey, Oscar. So you're here today with Oscar, who's a lovely tricolour sheepdog.
Yes, he gets a walk and we get a cup of tea and everyone gets to sit in the sun for a bit.
Yeah, when it's a nice day you can come down and they do really nice scones here and the tea is good and the dog always likes to go down to the river and he jumps in and it's just fun for everyone to be here.
Isn't that right, Oscar? It's a good boy. It's a good boy.
It's just such a nice thing to do on a sunny day to relax in the deck chairs and have a cup of tea, and I think all of Cambridge must be here today.
Oh yeah, it's a beautiful afternoon, you know, 20 degrees, sun out, where better to spend your time?
We had a Sunday roast, a chicken salad. They were much bigger portions than traditional British portions, so we were a little taken aback by that.
The deck chairs are part of what makes here unique. People migrate through here. The deck chairs move around, the tables move around. People find their own nice little spot. And I think it works beautifully. I think it's just part of old England.
We're getting ice creams maybe in a minute.
Has the coffee culture invaded here? We do serve proper ground coffee. I suspect that we are going to have to give in to a shush shush wang bang coffee machine at some stage in the future, but perhaps not this year, maybe next.
And Cambridgeshire, of all England, the shire for men who understand. And of that district, I prefer the lovely hamlet, Grantchester.
Robin's ambition of keeping here forever England and the name of Rupert Brooke alive will continue. But on a day like today, as we sit under the sunshine, enjoy this marvellous place of Grantchester. It's just truly, truly fantastic.
Yes, well it is, isn't it?
It was really, really nice. And thanks to Charles Bunker, the Orchard Tea Rooms in Grantchester, and of course the many visitors who spoke to me. Something I didn't include in that feature, though, was the Rupert Brooke Room. This is a room on site. It caters for 70 to 80-odd people. It can host things like birthday parties. Well, they used to do weddings there, and with Grantchester Church nearby, with a bit of luck, perhaps one day Charles is hoping that they might introduce wedding breakfasts back to the Orchard Gardens. The Orchard is at 45 Mill Way, Grantchester, and it's open every day of the year, with the exception of, say, days around Christmas, from 9:30 till 7 p.m. in the summer. It's a place that is now guaranteed to remain forever England.
That's great, and it is such a good place as well. Right, some news fresh in on Twitter. Rusty Strasser are at the Trumpington Meadows Discovery Day today, and they're serving until 3. Bridges on Bridge Street have a new juice menu, which will be good for this warm weather. Prana, the Indian restaurant in Mill Road, are about to launch a delivery service. That will happen in a few days' time.
Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
Dr. Sue Bailey lectures in food science at London Metropolitan University and lives near Cambridge. She'll be with us on most programmes for a bit of food science, and today, butter. So recipes often call for unsalted butter, and I often haven't got any. Does that matter?
It doesn't really matter at all, actually. I often think it's preference. A lot of French recipes may tend to use unsalted butter because that's the type of sort of sweet lactic acid type butter that they prefer to use. And so on the whole in the UK, we prefer to have our nice sort of salted English butter or wherever it particular part of the world it actually comes from. It doesn't really matter too much because if you're going to be adding salt to your food afterwards anyway, salted, unsalted, still fine to use salted, although obviously be careful about the amount of extra salt you're adding in there if you're trying to watch your blood pressure, for example. With unsalted butter, you perhaps might prefer to use that for making cakes or pastries or biscuits where you would otherwise prefer to have a sweeter rather than slight touch of saltiness to it. But the interesting thing is, often you may well add just a pinch of salt into those recipes historically to actually bring out the flavour and actually to interact with the flour protein so that you can perhaps roll out your pastry slightly more easily, for example.
So when a recipe says to use unsalted butter, but then tells you to add salt, that's simply just to get the amount of salt right then, really.
It really is, yes. Mm. So you could probably get away with actually using salted butter, so that would be fine, yes.
Yeah, right, good, I shall do.
Good.
And thanks to Sue Bailey, who will be back next time to tell us about some extraordinary research on how we are affected by the colour of foods.
Want to sponsor one of our shows or spots?
Perhaps our local travel or Cambridge weather takes your fancy.
Call us on Cambridge 967 105.
Or email sales@cambridge105.fm.
And get your business on air today.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. We're here every fortnight at noon on Saturday, repeated at 7 a.m. on Sunday, and podcast early in the week. And one of our pleasures is coffee. Jack Kiff is a barista at Hot Numbers, and he's previously been at Fitzbillies in Trumpington Street and at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street. He knows a lot about coffee, and I discovered that I didn't when I spoke with him in a busy Hot Numbers about the forthcoming barista jam. It's next Saturday.
And one of the things that's happening there is blind cupping. So is that what identifying the coffee from the...
Exactly, yeah. Cupping is how we analyse coffee. What it's doing is it's brewed coffee. We're going to have three samples, two of which are going to be the same, and then that other one's going to be the odd one out. And then you're going to have five sets of those. And then the idea is that each contender then has to try and pick out that individual coffee and say which one it is, and then also give a reason for why. So it could be origin, so like you could have two Brazilian coffees and a Colombian, so that would be origin, or could just be a taste, in case of one's Arabica, one's Robusta, just different things. We're going to try and we'll make some hard, we'll make some easy, just so people hopefully will get some right, but then challenge them and see if they can identify the hard ones.
So there's going to be baristas there, so it'll probably be quite competitive, will it, do you think?
I think the idea of it is to have fun, but I've done a competition before which was aimed at fun and it felt very, very competitive. I think people will take it in their own way. It should be a chance for people to improve and feel a bit of that kind of competitive heat. Just have a laugh, just learn from it, really. I suppose that's the main thing.
Well, talking about being a barista, is there a lot to know about to be a good one? I suppose anybody can do something badly, but to be a good barista, does it take a lot of training, a lot of knowledge?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I still consider myself as needing to learn a lot more. However, I do know a lot at the same time, but there's a lot to learn about coffee and just taking it in stages and taking it on board and making sure that you can just do everything, all the things that you learn well, and then before moving on to something new. If you're making espresso, for example, really home in on each stage of it, from the grinder to tamping to putting the shot, making sure everything is as perfect as you can get it.
When you grind coffee, I would have thought you put it in a grinder and it grinds it for you and that's the end of it.
You'd be going on what size grind you need and then the dose of it. So, for example, with us, we use 18 grams of coffee. So we need to make sure that the grinder, which produces, is on a timer. So it's, say, 4.5 seconds. It will grind coffee out in 4.5 seconds. And then you can alter the time to make sure that that is producing 18 grams of coffee. And then it's a case of if the grind's the right size. So if it's too coarse, the coffee will rush out through the coffee and under-extract. If you have it really fine and it takes really, really long time for the coffee, for the water to come through and the espresso to pour out, then that's going to be really over-extracted. So it's about getting everything right.
So if it's over-extracted or under-extracted, it will take either too little of the oils and the flavours.
Yeah, exactly. All the different compounds, so oils and all the acids and sugars and everything like that.
Right. And if it goes up through too slowly, then it will take out some of the things that you wouldn't want.
It would just take out too much, yeah. So over-extracted coffee tends to have a lot of bitterness to it and astringency, which is quite like a dryness in the mouth. And then under-extracted, you can get astringency as well, so slightly dry, but it's mainly sour and very sharp. Quite thin.
Yeah, and the tamping, which is the pressing down on the grinds in the...
So, yeah. There's been numerous studies, but basically you want to be tamping so that you've compacted the coffee enough so that there's no gaps, otherwise, because it's under 9 bar of pressure going through the water going through.
So that's 9 times atmospheric pressure?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So very high pressure. Any tiny little gap that the water will find, it will go straight to that, and therefore if it rushes to that gap, all that area will be over-extracted and then the rest of the basket will be under. So you'll have kind of contrasting flavours. You'll get some sour and some bitter. So the idea is you want to be tamping until you can't move it down further. Any more than that and it's not really going to make any difference.
And are some people naturally good at this or does it take everybody a bit of practice?
All depends on patience. The only thing that can come a bit more naturally to people is like the latte art side of things. Some people just pick that up a bit faster than others, but to be honest, at the end of the day, you just need to make a lot of coffee and then that's the only way you're going to really learn the techniques and everything. Yeah. And
my daughter had a coffee the other day, not in Cambridge, with a bear on it. Which took her rather by surprise, and she thought that might have been done through some sort of stencil or something.
Not at all. A lot of people do reckon it's sort of like, say, oh, is this a stencil? And it's just like, no, it's basically just pouring of the milk. Just the way that when you pour the milk into the cup, lower down so that the foam goes on top, it fans out to make the kind of bare head, and then the ears will be done just spooning the dollop of milk on top. And then the darker the kind of eyes and the nose and everything, that's purely from scooping some of the coffee crema or the coffee colour and just like drawing on basically. I prefer just kind of just free pouring patterns so you don't have to faff around with spoons and stuff. But you can do a number of things.
Well, I didn't know about
people
that.
Drawing coffee. So.
Okay. And in the barista jam, the latte art competition, probably some people will be doing bears and whatnot.
Well, I don't know. I hope not, to be honest. So the idea, we'll have a couple of latte art competitions. So one will do a best design, which will literally just be best pattern. And then we'll also be looking at things like how crisp the pattern is. So if it goes straight from bright white foam to then to the coffee, that's going to be really nice and crisp.
Right.
But sometimes you can get a bit of a kind of faded look going, which is just the way the milk's mixed in with the coffee. So that's going to be one of them. But then we're also going to have different size cups. So you'll have a big cup, a smaller cup, a smaller cup, a smaller cup, and you've got to do the best you can in each of those. And then another one we'll do a speed round. So you have to do as best pattern as possible, but as fast as you can kind of thing. So you'll be marked on time as well as how good your pattern is.
Right. Tell me about different styles of coffee. Is there a particularly popular one? I mean, I know you've worked in 3 Cambridge coffee houses. Does it vary between where you are as well?
To be honest, I mean, the main style that people will go for, obviously, is espresso. People love espresso-based coffees. Honestly, I find that most people go for a cappuccino. I'm not sure why that is. Because obviously, some people will know, some people don't, that we do it slightly differently here in that we don't differentiate between the names of coffees. We've got a 3-ounce, a 6-ounce, an 8-ounce, and a 10-ounce cup. They're double shot in each one. You top it up with either water or milk, steam milk, and then that's your cup. So the bigger cup will be less intense, won't be as strong, more diluted, and then it'll go down to get stronger and stronger. But obviously you do get people coming in and saying, oh, can I have a cappuccino, can I have a flat white kind of thing, which we all explain, and like it's the sizes can relate to flat white cappuccino latte, but the milk will obviously be different. But I'd say that most people do seem to like a cappuccino, or a flat white actually, to be fair.
Right.
The Australians have brought that over.
Yeah, and does it depend on the time of day? Do people have a sort of more intense caffeine hit in the mornings and the afternoon?
No, I wouldn't say. I'd say everyone just likes a caffeine hit whenever they want it, really. You get people ordering espressos like 5 o'clock, like 6 p.m. You know, people just like coffee, really.
Yeah.
And obviously, caffeine will react differently to some people. Some people it'll affect them really badly. and they'll be up all night. Some people, like myself, like I could probably have a cup of coffee at 7 o'clock and I'll still sleep fine.
Yeah, well, lucky you. Are there any new styles of coffee coming?
I wouldn't say too much at the moment. Last year there was a big thing on cold brew, which is basically letting coffee grounds steep in cold water for anything between kind of 12 to 24 hours. So we've got a cold brew on, which was part of our like summer range. That kind of took off quite a lot last year. Other than that, I would just say it's, in terms of from my perspective on coffee, is I'm more looking at what kind of beans other roasters are getting in and what seems to be really popular and things like that. I think at the moment, in terms of coffee beans, there's a coffee bean called Geisha, which is a kind of variety of coffee bean, which is really highly prized and very expensive, but it does produce an amazing cup of coffee, and people have caught on to that a lot more, and you'll see every now and then a roaster will get some Geisha coffee in, which is phenomenal.
And is there any around in Cambridge at the moment?
Not at the moment, no. I don't know if we'll be getting any in, as it is quite expensive, and normally it gets snapped up pretty quick as well. But I had some when I was in Copenhagen, which was phenomenal.
And where's it grown?
So it was the good cup of coffee that it won the Cup of Excellence, which Lee from Panama. It is grown in other places, but it hasn't got as good publicity from those other countries. So yeah, if you, it's mainly from Panama, that's the real kind of prized crop.
Yeah. It is similar, isn't it, to wine, where the same grape grown in different countries will give you a different taste.
Absolutely, yeah.
Different experience.
I mean, yeah, the bean is just part of it. So you can have a typical variety grown in, let's say, Brazil, for example, and there's certain altitude, type of soil, then the way it's processed, all that can vary. So if it's grown in Colombia, it will vary.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Right. So there's a gradings of coffee then according to the quality.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's done on a 100-point scale. There'll be different attributes. So it'll go from things like body, acidity, sweetness, cleanness, aftertaste. All these kind of things will be ranked, and if it scores over 80 points, then that's considered specialty coffee. Anything under will be commodity coffee, and then that will severely affect the price as well and everything.
And the coffee you mentioned before as being a particularly outstanding one, what sort of points range is that around?
I'm pretty sure that's hitting around 95. Kind of probably almost going like 97, yeah, around there. The kind of coffees that we've got in, I'm pretty sure we're falling around like the 85 mark, some maybe a little bit higher, but in Ethiopian that we've just got in, I think probably score a little bit higher, but it's all really interesting though.
You obviously use, you know, a lot of different coffees over a period of time.
Yeah.
Do you have to learn their characteristics in order to get the best out of them, or do you just wham them all in the same, you know?
We've got, so from when we say we like this Ethiopian that we've just got in, we'll have a kind of rough profile in our head as like to how an Ethiopian, right, they're very nice and kind of fruity, kind of berry acidity and some kind of floral notes. That's kind of what, almost before we've tasted it, like that's what you're kind of thinking is a rough guideline. Obviously it can be totally different, but then what we'll do is we'll go through the sample roaster, which is just behind you, then we'll cup it and taste it, see what we can get out of it, and maybe adjust the roast profile in case we think it was just a bad roast and not the bean, and then from that we can then pick out flavour notes, aromas, etc., and go from there, and then we can assess if we think, oh, this could be best as a filter coffee, and filter coffee being a lot more delicate, highlighting on nice acidity, or we can run it through as an espresso, which you can obviously get nice acidity, but you're going to be focusing a lot more on the body and kind of creaminess of the espresso. So just, yeah, depending on what we think the coffee will suit best, really.
Right. What a process. Thanks very much, Jack.
And that was Jack Kiff, and I thought that was absolutely fascinating. There's so much to know about coffee. Mm. The geisha coffee, geisha being spelt like Japanese geisha girls, is 10 times the price of the average coffee. A packet of Panamanian geisha, if you went into a shop and bought a pack of it, will cost you around £35, whereas most coffee packs cost about £3.25. And there's a coffee house in Bristol that has some at the moment, apparently, if you're desperate to try it out.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
A couple more tweets. It's World Gin Day today, if you were wondering, and the Pint Shop is celebrating with lots and lots of gins. Also, Gorilla Kitchen is out, the Strawberries and Cream Festival today, and that's in Barton.
Lovely. Now, grog. That's a good word to start with. Grog can be a variety of alcohols, and Thirsty is the name of a shop on Chesterton Road that sells it. Wine, beer, coffee, friends and fun. This is Thirsty's aim. They opened their shop last September, and last weekend they held their first ever Thirsty Fest.
Hi chaps, got your tickets?
Yeah.
Check in at the desk there.
Yep.
Flight number Thirsty Fest Airways.
That's Sam Owens. He and his business partner Matthew Boucher run Thirsty.
A bit of theatre, a bit of fun, a bit of knowledge, and hopefully a thirstiness too.
It's a Saturday evening, the sun is out, time for some music.
I left my love in Avalon.
Courtesy of Ian Mann and the Hot Club of Cambridge.
Bienvenue to Thirsty Fest.
Can I please have the Mexican lager? It's divine.
We're Hot Numbers Coffee. We're here joining everyone at Thirsty.
Because there's such a wave in new craft micro distilleries in the UK.
It's a lovely summery drink.
As someone who loves gin, loves wine, and makes beer, I'm in my element.
I'm walking into a barn, a funky barn. Three floors of gin, beer, wine, cider, and art, too. Because a good drink isn't something that should be worshipped in isolation, as the Thirsty Fest booklet says. The idea is to introduce visitors to all kinds of interesting drinks that Thirsty has that you may not find elsewhere in the city. I headed for the gin room.
I'm John Hall, I'm head distiller at Trevethan Distillery. Myself and my business partner Rob have been working in the food production for about 6 years now.
They have a chemistry background.
We decided we wanted to make a product of our own. Distilled spirits seemed the way to go, we could see where the market was going. And Rob actually told me a story about his granddad, Norman Trevethan. And he used to make his own homemade version of gin back in the 1920s. So I spent some time working with Rob's mum, who was the only person still alive that had ever tried this gin. Found out what the sort of hedgerow botanicals he might have been using, the flavours that she thought that were in there. So she said there was a spicy kick, so we put some cardamom in. We knew that he was using a lot of gorseflower and elderflower in his other homebrewed wines and things like that. So we've made something that I hope is as close to his recipe as we can get, and I hope it does it justice. Sadly, he's not around to drink it, but I'd like to think he would enjoy it if he did have some. So we always encourage people to sip our gin straight. The way I'd say to do it is to take one small sip and just line your tongue. And then the second sip, take a bit more gin, but hold it in the mouth for 5 to 6 seconds. The reason you do that is you've got 10 botanicals in the gin and you want to give it time for the flavour to come through. We say about half a second for every botanical.
Yeah.
So we'd get 15, 20 people into a room. We try ourselves against Hendrix, against Chase, against Sipsmith. Completely blind taste tests. We consistently came in the top one or two. So we knew that we had a good flavour, good product. So we've got orange and rosemary, which is one of the combinations, and then we've got lemon and thyme. And that's to do with the time of year, but similarly, at Christmas, I'd probably do orange and clove, because you've got cardamom and vanilla in there, which you want to maybe combine with a bit of a spicy note and make it a bit more of a warmer drink as well. So I think you can get lots of different flavours out of one gin. You just need to know how to serve it and how to work with it. You can find us at trevethandistillery.com. Our product is available at Thirsty, and they're the only guys in Cambridge that sell us at the moment.
Yeah, hi, I'm John from Amethyst Drinks. We're a London-based wholesaler and importer, if you like, one of which is a German gin called Ferdinand's Gin from the Saar region in Germany. And that's what I've been presenting today at the Thirsty Fest. It's essentially a gin that is infused with Riesling, and it's very high-quality Riesling from the Zilliken Estates in Germany. So I hear it's sold very well already. We'd already sold a few bottles this morning when it was reasonably quiet, and this afternoon's been madness. And I've had a few people coming up saying that's literally the finest spirit they've ever tasted, which is absolutely fantastic. And you do wonder if people are just saying that just to get a free bit of drink. It's got a lovely sweet finish, and people don't expect it. Even though I tell them, I say, look, it's got a sweet finish. And they go, oh, yes, okay. And then they try it, and they go, oh, it is sweet. I say, well, I did warn you, but it's a lovely non-cloying sweetness. And for further information, then check out the website, amethystdrinks.com.
Moving on to Pinkster Gin now. This is a local gin outfit I've been meaning to cover for ages.
I'm going to put a hefty measure of the old Pinkster in the glass there, fill it up with some tonic.
We garnish it with a fresh raspberry and some mint, but you have to spank the mint. And in order to spank the mint, you pick off a little leaf, put it between your palms, pretend it's a very naughty piece of mint, give it a good spank. Put that in the glass. Bob's your uncle, the world's best gin and tonic. From Pinks to Gin, obviously the best gin company ever in the world. Thank you.
Having a space that's a little bit more interesting means that the drinking experience is more interesting.
This venue isn't a bar, it's not a pub, and the people really appreciated that because what they liked was the fact that it was something so wildly different. It was a cool venue, that's what it was.
Yeah. The building is a Victorian warehouse. There are very few buildings like this in Cambridge. Yeah, you won't find original Victorian buildings with open beams and natural brickwork and beautiful arched windows, and that's what we love about it.
That was Emma Kerr, owner of the Bodywork Company. They use this site at all other times.
We've been here for 35 years and it was a furniture warehouse. I believe it was the Eden Lilly's furniture warehouse. And it was really nice for us to be able to open our doors because Bodywork has always been about the community. So it was really nice just to get that little bit of a connection, and I hope they'll come back again one day, and it was really nice to have them.
It was Matt and Sam who contacted you and who wanted to stock your gin, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. We were contacted a few months ago. It was wonderful, actually, to be approached. So my business partner, Kathy, and I were set up on a business blind date by a mutual friend who said, you two love gin. You two should make gin together. And we had one of those sort of conversations in a pub where you go, oh, my God, wouldn't it be great? Why has no one made Brighton gin before? We should make Brighton gin.
That was...
My name is Helen Cheshire. I'm one of the two founders of Brighton Gin. And we've had an amazing day, the Thirsty Fest. We use 100% organic British wheat, juniper, fresh orange peel, fresh lime, coriander seed that's grown within 15 miles of our distillery, and milk thistle, which is indigenous to the South Downs and known for its liver cleansing properties. I think it's really nice to see how a small retail environment can change a community. Having a wine shop and then suddenly it being a real centre of everywhere, where everyone goes to, you know, to buy their wines, buy their spirits. So we're really active on social media, and I think that's what's working for the Thirsty Guys. So we're on Twitter, we're at Brighton Gin. We're on Instagram, Distilled Beside the Seaside. Facebook, I think I've even got a Snapchat just to be trendy and down with the kids.
I've spent most of my evening on the second floor with all the beer drinkers. Several of my friends have been downstairs trying out the local gins, and it's been a tremendous evening and a tremendous success all round.
Hello, I'm here for the beer.
So you are Bexar County and your name is?
It's Steve.
Now Steve, the first thing that drew my eye straight away is that you have a lovely spicy chipotle red rye Arcanum. Now that's a very unusual beer in my eyes. I just wondered if you could explain a little bit more about it.
Yeah, basically I wanted to make a beer that wasn't mainstream. I wanted to make something that was slightly spicy but not over the top. Something that everyone could accept. I had a bunch of rye and I really like rye. Rye seems to be in the rage right now. And chipotle is one of my favorite flavors. So you put them together, it's amazing. So that's the beer.
And the visitors' reaction to this beer?
So far it's been positive that nobody spit it out, so that's a good thing.
So you have a variety here. You also have one called Cookie Monster.
Yeah, Cookie Monster uses tonka beans, which is something that not many people understand what they are. It's a culinary bean, has a bit of a vanilla and marzipan and dark cherry pit, actually. It's really nice, but it's slightly different.
It wasn't all far-flung producers. There were some familiar faces, too, like the Calverley brothers, who started their own brewery on Hooper Street just the other year.
Luckily, the brewery is only a few hundred metres away, so we have had a quick top-up run. My brother came over with a few extra 4-pint carry kegs straight from the brewery.
I've been upstairs once, I've been downstairs once. To be honest, it's been so busy this evening that, frankly, the next 20 minutes I will be spending drinking as much wine and as much gin as I possibly can.
I must say, I'm a bit gutted I didn't manage to get up to the top floor during Thirsty Fest. I spent so much time with the gin people and then half that time again with the beer people, and before I knew it, the night was over. It was such a quick evening. I counted about 61 different drinks at this event, and all I can hope to give you here is the merest flavour. This was about getting across the fun, the atmosphere, and the choice available from Thirsty Fest, all of which you can find at their shop on 46 Chesterton Road.
It was a great atmosphere, and I had a really wonderful time. Definitely recommend it to everyone.
I have to say, the three floors of tastings, all segment, sorry. It was one of the most excellent
beer evenings I've had. For me, it beat the Cambridge Beer Festival as well.
As far as it did.
The Cambridge Beer Festival has more beers. However, I feel the selection and the choice that was available at Thirsty Fest was much more interesting than the beer festival, I've got to be honest.
It's such a lovely company, Thirsty, that are supplying lovely wines, lovely spirits, lovely beers. And it's really nice to meet all of the customers here on a really sunny Saturday in Cambridge.
I hope it happens again. It's been brilliant.
Fair play to Sam. He may dress as a beer very regularly, including on normal evenings.
It's not obvious on radio, but Sam was there dressed up all day as a bottle of beer.
I think he actually slept in it as well, apparently. Works well as a sleeping bag or a ski suit, depending on which way you want to go.
But he's not an embarrassment. He's a matter of pride for Cambridge.
Yeah, they held Thirsty Fest on the same day as Strawberry Fair, but they sold all of their tickets. People were happy to spend the day going between the two events. And based on the success of this first Thirsty Fest, it looks like they might just do another, perhaps with more wine, beer, street food and live music. And there's a night market in Market Square that they might get involved with too, as well as plenty of evening plans at Thirsty on 46 Chesterton Road. So, it's all systems go for them.
Busy week, hectic Saturday? Why not tune in to the Sunday Breakfast Show from 8 a.m? Join me, Phil Rowe, to start the day with some relaxing tunes, challenge the little grey cells with the now legendary Cambridge Quiz, hear what's going on locally, nationally and internationally with our newspaper reviewer from our area, and listen to interviews with local people to find out what's happening in your local community. The Sunday Breakfast Show, a great way to start your day here on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Over to Trumpington Allotments now, where Alan spoke with gardening expert Dave Fox about what to look out for if you're growing your own produce.
Dave, things are growing really well at the moment, but there are some risks. The risk of potato blight or tomato blight. What should we do to check whether we're likely to succumb to it?
Yes, well, you're right. I mean, for a start, it's really good growing weather. It's wet and then it's dry and lots of sunshine and the day length's long, so things are growing really well. Yes, potato blight, it's called late blight. That can be a really devastating disease of potatoes, and then later in the season, the same disease will affect tomatoes as well. I think it's useful to look a little bit at the history of it, because that was the cause of the Irish potato famine. So 160 years ago or more, what happened was the blight attacked one summer, and the crop was really, really badly affected, so much of it was not worth harvesting, and many of the farmers ploughed the potatoes back into the fields and replanted the next year, and the disease came back even worse the next year. And the reason for that is that it's a fungal disease which overwinters in potato tubers in the ground. So that's the key to fighting against it. Don't leave old potatoes in the ground. If you see weed potatoes, and volunteers they're called, growing where you had your potato patch the previous year, dig out those plants because they're very likely to be infected. So get them out. You might even get some early new potatoes to eat. Perfectly good to eat. But dig them out, get rid of them off-site, into the green bin is the best way. And then that reduces the chance of an early start of the disease on your new crop, which you've planted with certified seed, which is free of the disease. So that's the way to do it. And if you see weed potatoes growing on your neighbour's plots, tell them about it, because of course novices don't recognise the problem, they don't know about the life cycle, and you often see potatoes growing out of compost bins. Well, they're again very likely to be infected and be a source of an early spread of the disease. So it's not, you know, it's not the end of the world, is it? We can always buy potatoes. they're fairly cheap in the shops.
Yeah. But it's how worth being aware. How can you tell whether your potatoes have actually got it? And if they have, is it too late?
It's not too late to do something about it. So when blight manifests, you see a blotchiness on the leaf. And if you look underneath the potato leaf, then you see a sort of white, mildewy little patch. So you see a dark spot on the upper side of the leaf and a mildewy patch on the bottom. And that's best seen early in the morning for some reason. It's easier to identify then. And that blotch will be a lot bigger the next day, and the next day most leaves on the plant are affected, and then after that it spreads pretty quickly. It only spreads in certain conditions. I think the temperature has to be consistently above something like 10 or 11 degrees, and the humidity has to be quite high, relative humidity of 90% or something, and if that persists for 48 hours, it's called a Smith period. It's the ideal conditions for the spread of blight. And if you really want to be on top of things, sign up to Blight Watch, which is online, and then you can get email warnings when there's a Smith period in your postcode area. So yeah, I mean, that's for the main thing to do is just try and be tidy, don't leave old potatoes lying around, and if you do see these blotches developing, you can cut that leaf off into the green bean, get it off site, and that'll slow down the spread of the disease. Having said that, you know, it's pretty inevitable when you get a blighty period, eventually it will spread, so the best thing you can do is really just delay it.
And I suppose another thing that we might need advice on as summer comes is watering. I mean, certainly here in Trumpington, the ground is the soil is quite light. It doesn't retain water for very long. So should we be out here every day with our watering cans?
No, certainly not every day, and certainly not as we record this approaching midday with sun beating down and lugging cans of water around at this time. It's really quite ineffectual because the evaporation rate will be very high because the soil is very warm. So I would say, do your watering early in the morning, preferably, or late evening, second best. The reason I say that's second best is because if you water in the evening, then the slugs and snails have got every chance to spend all night munching in damp conditions. So that's a bit of a bonus for them, whereas in dry weather, they sort of tend to stay hidden and probably don't get so much to eat. So early morning watering is probably best if you can get there before work, maybe. If you are out in the garden over the next month or two, wear a sun hat, get some sunblock on, because you know, I've unfortunately had to spend a lot of time in the oncology unit recently and seen people with skin cancer, so you know, best avoid it. It's one of the dangers in gardening. You can forget about it because it's so nice, isn't it, to be out in the sunshine, and this is the time when the sun's really at its most most powerful, so yeah, be careful. So, Alan, I'd like to show you my lupin flower, if you don't mind. Well, firstly, we'll have a look at Tim's lupin next door, which is beautiful, lovely sort of crimson flowers, and healthy plant. And you could cut them for flowers in the house if you wanted, or it looks perfectly nice out here. Then we'll have a look at my lupin. So this is a disaster. It was a strong plant with lots of good flower spikes coming. About 3 weeks ago, I noticed the grey mealybug aphid thingies starting to congregate and breed on the flower spikes, and I thought, oh, the ladybirds will come along and munch them up. So I'll leave it. Not at all. The aphids have completely taken over. The flower spikes are now drooping, covered in greyness, and it's just completely gone. So that's just an illustration of what can happen when the pests get away. A bit surprising, really, because it's been quite a good year for ladybirds. I would have thought that they would come and, just didn't have the right balance here. So there we go.
So what was the other alternative? So you presumably wouldn't have been happy to spray it?
No, probably not spray. I mean, there's horticultural soap, which you can usually get in solution, and that's quite effective. It does something to do with the surface tension in the water, and they sort of fall off. But if you spot them early enough, then just squish them with your fingers, and then you can have a big impact on the population. Your sticky fingers, but you can wash them afterwards, and that'll certainly slow them right down, and maybe get it back to the point where the ladybirds can take care of them. But I think with this plant, I'm now actually going to dig it out and say goodbye to it. But you know, having said all that, don't worry too much about pests and diseases in advance. I mean, it's better to be observant and take action, recognise if you can through experience when problems start developing, because this thing with gardening books, there's always a big section on pests and diseases, and I see novices on the allotments taking action against pests and diseases before they've even happened. So, the main thing to remember is that plants want to grow. And, you know, if you've got good viable seed and halfway decent soil and keep an eye out, you know, most things you'll have a degree of success with. So
disastrously thin, but never mind.
Keep off the chemicals.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
That's nice.
Well, thanks to Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments for that advice. And Dave will be back in a few minutes' time, actually, to tell you about a plant swap we're all invited to at Trumpington Allotments.
I love the allotment ambience you got there at the beginning. Really lovely.
Yeah, it was fantastic. The number of birds singing, the number of bees buzzing, it really was extraordinary.
And at the end, too, of course.
Well, let's stay in Trumpington and go to Noel Young Wines for some tips on summer drinking from Dan Young, who agrees that it's time to bring out the whites and rosés.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a couple, actually. We're going to do a little mini feature on Spain. Lots of new regions from Spain coming out at the moment, which is excellent. And also a few interesting things from the more traditional regions that we know about, like Rioja. And we're going to feature a rosé from Rioja, which I don't think you see very often. But the first wine we're doing is Moscatel from a region called Jumilla, which is just east of Alicante, so quite southerly, and definitely a region you'd much more associate with producing quite big, quite heavy red wines. So this is a fantastic, very lovely, bright, fresh, summery white. Moscatel is always quite grapey. It's also known as Muscat, same grape variety. So very fragrant, very sort of citrus fruit based style. Got a little bit of spice, stone fruits, and that sort of real grapey. It almost as if it's going to sort of taste sweet, but actually it's really quite dry. So that can fool people, but lovely with the, you know, lovely aperitif, very good with some nice sort of fragrant salads, that type of thing. So that's really good. And just about £10 a bottle for that one.
Right.
And the rosé, it's from La Cuna de la Poesia. I'm sure my pronunciation of that was terrible, but who's going to correct me? So yeah, as I said, very, very different to have a rosé from Rioja. It's obviously, again, traditionally thought of as quite sort of oaky whites and reds. This is completely un-oaked, made from 100% Grenache, or Garnacha as they call it in Spain, and quite delicate, quite refreshing style. You get the lovely sort of strawberry notes, which is quite classic for Grenache. A little bit of, again, crisp acidity just to keep the balance, but generally quite fruity, but still very much a dry rosé. It's not remotely sweet. Again, this would be very good with maybe some fish on the barbecue, if that's not too optimistic. But again, otherwise, you know, those just very sort of good with picnics, or if you just got a nice sort of, you know, spread like tapas-y style sort of spread, so lots of flavours going on, then this will slot in really well. And the same price, so just over the £10.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much. Yeah, that was Dan Youngs from Noel Young Wines in Trumpington, who do a delivery service too, by the way. Now the moments I've been dreading. The names of the wines were Juan Gil Moscatel Seco. Well, that one went okay.
Yep.
And the rosé was Cuna la Poesia Rioja Rosado. So there you go. And on Twitter, Fiona Beckett has just tweeted with some food matches for rosé. So there's some more food matches.
Lovely. On to the food and drink news now for Cambridge, beginning with jobs. Afternoon Teas in King Street is looking for someone who can work as a baker and a cook. The post is permanent, 37 and a half hours a week, and training can be given. Details are on Gumtree. And Cambridge Wine Merchants in Bridge Street is recruiting part-time retail staff. Experience in retail and wine preferred. You'll need to be available for evenings and weekends.
After 6 years, Inda's Kitchen is stopping their home delivery of hot meals to concentrate on frozen meals, which are excellent, by the way, and on pop-ups. They'll have a monthly meal at their kitchen in Clifton Road 2, and the first of these Bombay Eats nights will take place on Saturday, June the 18th. This will be an exclusive yet very informal evening of Indian tapas, music, and a range of Indian cocktails and lassis, and a full bar serving alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. And if you've ever had any of Inda's food before, you'll know that these will be good. The kitchen and bar will open at 5 p.m. with last orders at 10:30. This event will take place once a month throughout the summer, and places will be limited to 100 people, so you'll need to book as soon as possible. You can email info@indaskitchen.com or call Cambridge 211 333, and you can find the menu on their website.
The Cambridge Food Assembly, where you order via their website from local independent producers, who then deliver and you pick up, is reopening on the 29th of June at a new venue. The venue is the Tram Depot on Dover Street, just off East Road. There's a car park there too, that's from 5:30 to 7 p.m. All the old favourites will be there, and some new ones too, so keep checking the Cambridge Food Assembly website for details.
Right now, and finishing tomorrow, is the Bridge Street Beer Festival. It's being held at the Mitre, Pickerel and Baron of Beef pubs, and there are more than 30 ales and ciders.
Some pop-ups happening at the Queen's Head in Newton. 15th of June, it's Jalan Jalan. 22nd of June is Smokeworks. And on the 29th of June, Holy Schnitzels.
And on the 18th of June, as we've heard a little about already, there's a barista jam at Hot Numbers in Gwydra Street. And interested local coffee-loving folk are invited for an evening of socialising and coffee fun. There'll be a well-stocked bar with some special coffee stouts and porters. There'll also be snacks and cakes to soak up some of the caffeine, and local baristas will be showing off their skills in a friendly, competitive way. And Holy Schnitzel will be serving up food outside too. Sounds like fun. Starts at 7 p.m. and entry is free. There's more information on the Hot Numbers Facebook page.
And news from Dave Fox now about a plant swap.
On Sunday the 19th of June, there's a plant swap at Trumpington Allotments. So that's 10:30 in the morning, and it's on the web if you search for Trumpington Allotments, or look on the Transition Cambridge newsletter.
And do you have to be a member of Trumpington
Allotments? No. Everyone's welcome, and it's free. And bring plants and swap them for other plants. And if you feel bad about taking things without actually bringing any plants, you can give us a small donation. So I'll say that's so everyone's welcome. 10:30. Main advice, get there on time, because obviously all the good plants go first.
And
some advance notice. The Cambridge Blues Summer Beer Festival this year is from the 5th to the 10th of July with 100 ales, cake ciders and perries, and that's in Gwydra Street.
And that's all the time we have for today's Flavour. The programme is repeated tomorrow morning at 7, podcast early next week, and you can follow us on Twitter at Flavour105.
Coming up next on Cambridge 105, Bookmark at 2, Radio Dante, and at 3, Summer Saturday comes from, amongst other places, the Town and Country Fair on Parker's Peace. At 5, Tony Barnfield with Roundabout Cambridge. 6, Mike Pryor's Saturday Soul. And 7, a programme I like a lot, Club Global, and that's DJ Skunk with World Music. And at 8, Paul Cristoforo talks with Brian Adams from Nick Cave's Bad Seeds. Finally, from 10 until 12, Houseology. But until the 25th of June, that's all from Flavour. Thanks for listening, and don't miss our page in today's Cambridge News. And
goodbye.